This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 22nd of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we're back in Milan for part two of our Salone del Mobile special. First up, we're at the Republic of Fritz Hansen showroom, chatting to head of design Christian Grosen Rasmussen and designer Jaime Heon about his new pieces for the brand.
This is metamorphin. It's going from one form to another, to another, to another, giving the functions to every one of the tables that we're proposing.
We stop at the design district of Brera to meet with US design brand Bassam Fellows at their new store to discuss the city's design retail landscape.
We also wanted pieces that would be great for more intimate conversation. So we often find that a lot of lounge seating is so overscaled and actually not very comfortable when you're sitting and having a conversation.
And designer Yves Bahar opens up about his living office project with US furniture manufacturer Herman Miller.
We don't go to work to use the copier or to send a fax. We can do all of that from the parking lot. We go to work to get in front of other people, to share ideas, to bounce things off each other, to make our ideas better, stronger, faster.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Although Italian design still ruled at Salone del Mobile this year, there were plenty of the world's biggest design brands presenting their new wares here too. Needless to say, Danish design got a good airing, most notably at the showroom of the Republic of Fritz Hansen, where a new reissue by Danish master Arne Jacobsen was launched, among many other pieces. Monocle's Josh Fennett caught up with Fritz Hansen's head of design, Christian Grosen Rasmussen, at the showroom on Via Garibaldi to discuss the ongoing popularity and strengths of Scandinavian style, even in the Italian industry. He also met Valencia-based designer Jaime Heon, who gave us a walkthrough of his new pieces for the manufacturer.
This year we are introducing a new table by Jaime Heon, Spanish designer, and we are introducing a chair designed by Arne Jacobsen in 1958 called the Drop Chair. We're adding a little bit of new flavor to it because originally it was upholstered, but this year we are also introducing it in injection molded plastic. So it's a kind of, you could say, a new interpretation of that chair. It's the original design, but the material has changed.
And we can't ignore the setting, although it's quite quiet out here in the back garden of the showroom. We are at Salone, which is obviously a huge design event where the world comes and forms its opinion about designs for the year to come. How important is it for Fritz Hansen to get out here and show people the designs and also to see what other people are doing? How important is the fair?
I think the Milan Fair is by far the most important in the world. It's when it comes to design furniture, it's the place to be. Everybody is in Milan this week, so that's also why it's so interesting to become inspired and hopefully also inspire others who come here to the showroom and show them what we're doing. It's only 1 week. It would be great if it was 14 days because then you could see everything, but you have to be really selective and pick the things that you want to see because. I think there are so many really good and inspiring things to see. Especially, I think this year it seems like there's a growing optimism and a lot of new stuff coming up. And it's really, I think it's so far, I've only been here 2 days so far, but it's very inspiring.
I've been here for 2 days as well, and I've had a chance to go up to the Fera, the kind of carnival that is all of the kind of packed halls. And I've seen a lot of new technology, a lot of 3D printing, a lot of futuristic designs. But your collection seems to be a little bit more kind of analog, a bit more functional, a bit more kind of Danish. Can you tell me a little bit about the overall direction as a design director that you've decided to take?
Well, we have quite a precise design philosophy in Fritz Hansen, which of course emerges from our history and our heritage. It's quite natural because quite a big part of our business is still like X and Swans and the products from the 50s and 60s. So we would like to draw a sort of red line from the past to the future. So Fritz Hansen is really about combining past, present and future and showing how we can create new products together with new young designers by doing that, sort of underline the qualities in the classic products, at the same time underlining the quality in the new products, and sort of bridge those two, and hopefully create a sort of landscape of beauty in the future, which is relevant to our audience.
So you mentioned new designers. Jaime is obviously the one whose table is launching today. He did a sofa for you, I think, 2 years ago, and maybe a chair last year also. How did you kind of decide to work with him? What is it about working with him that you see so much promise in?
First of all, he's a very, very nice guy, but he's also an extremely talented and creative designer. And I think he's also proven when working with a range of other brands that he really manages to reinterpret the values of the brand and point out maybe a new direction without sort of spoiling the brand or losing himself, but this keeping a very nice balance for the brand. And of course we are also quite controlling in the process because we wanted to all our new products, of course, to fit to the existing collection. But it's nice to sort of get some input from someone with a completely different design background and see how he interprets our design values. So he's not allowed to change our values, of course, but we would like him to interpret our values, and that's what he's doing, and I think he's doing really well.
My name is Jaime Hayon. I'm a designer. I'm Spanish. I'm from Madrid. And we're here at the Fritz Hansen showroom in Milan during the Salone del Mobile for introducing this new table that is called Analog.
And I've seen the table upstairs. It's a beautiful design. It's taken a lot from the kind of the timeless Danish qualities of the Fritz Hansen brand. But I wonder what it kind of means personally to you to develop the table and what the idea of a kind of analog table is.
Well, the most important thing of the table is that, first of all, it's like in a really important part of the house, you know. So for me, to design an interesting table, it was a very hard job. Basically, the key point of the design here is that it's not a square table, it's not a round table, it's not an elliptical table. What I want it to be is a new form. It's a new form, and this is the first thing you notice when you see it. It's actually a new form which doesn't have a name. I mean, if you go to a geometry book, you will not find it. So maybe you can call it Hayonic form, because it is actually a form that hasn't been thought just for aesthetical reason. It's a form that it's done for a useful and a very, let's say, like functional way of using the table. The table is proposed in different dimensions, and the form changes, so it doesn't evolve, like, for example, in the circle, that when you have 3, then you go to 6, then you go to 8. At a certain moment, the circle is just growing. This is metamorphing. It's going from one form to another, to another, to another, giving the functions to every one of the tables that we're proposing. The form is very simple, but at the end, it's also solved very easily. You have 4 legs in it. There's a union in aluminium, and there is a very, very sharp shaved top, which gives the beauty to it. The slight, you know, it's very, very, very light and very smooth, you know, which is what I wanted. Obviously, that's quality of the Danish, having beautiful woods on the top, nice quality materials put together. So this is it.
What happens when you take the corners off a table? Is it about kind of democratizing what happens when you sit there? I mean, when I look at the 8-seater table, I can see easily sitting 10 people around there, and no one's quite at the head of the table. No one's quite kind of excluded. No one's got the corner seat. Was that the idea?
Well, you got it really right. This is exactly what we're trying to do, because what we analyze is what is the most important in all these categories of tables that I was saying to you. On that circular one, what it allows you is like there's never one making the biggest presence in the table. In this one, it happens the same. And what I wanted to show is that the key point of the analog table is that it's a table that has been analyzed in the way we use tables. And in order for the people to understand that, we had to make a sort of artistic way of showing how it's used by making projections that show different daily scenes, such a birthday, you know, with kids and kids dancing on the table, but taking candies and things, or like serious meeting in which there's a signature happening, or like a dinner, a romantic dinner, a solution. You can show how generous the table can be in its size, and how easily movement happens in it, and how you can make different things around. So it's a very cute way to show the public in a very fast way how it really works and how it's been thought. So for me, it's also easier to explain to people, but it's a table to talk to you. You know, it's a table that suddenly is telling you, hey, this is how it's to be used.
So Fritz Hansen is a Danish brand, and we've talked about the kind of the timeless quality of Danish design. But this is your third project. You did the sofa initially, then the chair, then the kind of table. I wonder how you're from Madrid. You're not, you're Madrileño.
Madrileño, yeah.
How does your kind of that sort of Spanish flair and the Spanish kind of history of design engage with Danish design? And how do you think you as a designer have grown from working with Fritz Hansen?
There's something that links us really, really well, which is like I'm a designer of quality. You know, in general, I like quality. You know, I think I try to filter the design world in two kinds of designers. And in this, I've been analyzing a lot, you know. It's hard to say that, but I can tell you that there's two type of designers. There's the quantity designers and there's the quality designers. And quality means a lot of things. So with Fritz Hansen at the end, there's a link in between us from the beginning. It's that we want to achieve quality no matter what. And this is already like we're part of the same blood, you know. We want to analyze to make it better. We want to have materials in perfection. We want to use the good things and not whatever. And we want to offer honest things to people.
Jaime Heon speaking with our very own Josh Fennett there at the Fritz Hansen showroom in Milan. Amongst the thousands of exhibitors at this year's Salone, Section D producer Ale John managed to collar an unlikely design duo at the Design Junction event space. This was where the furniture brand Modus was exhibiting the work of Grange Smith. It's a collaboration between the iconic British industrial designer, an octogenarian, Sir Kenneth Grange, and recent postgraduate and young designer Jack Smith. They told Alet how this particular meeting of minds came to pass.
Well, I suppose it comes to pass because I've got a job at the Royal College, which is a visiting professorship, and a few years ago Jack was there as one of the students. And then he very, very generously chipped in a lot of time and skill helping to put my show together at the Design Museum a couple of years ago. And we've subsequently done a few things together where he's been really big help to me. And I was approached by Modus to design a sofa suite, I call it. And I thought, well, you know, there's only one bloke I'd really like to work with, and it's this man. So it ought to be clear that we've done it together.
Jack, that's a hell of an accolade coming from Sir Kenneth Grange, is it not?
Very flattering. As I said to someone earlier, I mean, you know, not to make Kenneth turn red, but he's someone I've been looking up to since, you know, since my sort of postgrad days. He's just been there. My mum used his machines. It's a bit of a, it's such an opportunity that, you know, just to work with him, let alone have my name next to him on a product is hugely flattering, and it's not something that comes along every day. So it's, and also in the way that there are many designers out there, there's not many that would let the people that they work with put their name to it. Kenneth has been uncommonly generous to allow that, so it's really, really nice.
So Kenneth, are you still excited about working in the industry?
Yeah, I'm going to take it to my grave, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I suppose my ambition is actually to pop me clogs with a job not quite finished.
It's an idea that I've spoken to a couple of other designers. They always say there's never such a thing as a finished product, because as a designer you're always wanting to tweak the work that you've been worked on.
Of course. And sometimes they come up, you know, if you live long enough, it's extraordinary how things eventually come back and clout you, or you welcome. And I, you know, I did a train a long time ago. Do you know, just 30-odd years ago I did the bloody thing. More. But because they haven't commercially, economically been pressed into improving the thing, just keeping it updated, it's in 30, 40 years not had virtually anything done to the toilets and the luggage and the steps and the door opening. Do you know you have to lower the window, reach out and grab a bloody soot encrusted handle in order to open the sodding door? I mean, isn't that extraordinary? I mean, you can't open a front door, let alone a motor car door, by anything like that. And yet they've never been pressed into changing it. So there's a raft of improvements that can be made to the thing, because it's a very good piece of engineering. Functionally, it works bloody well. The sort of breakdown rates very low, etc. But it just needs bringing right up to scratch. And I think that's I couldn't wish for a better outcome if they go ahead with those improvements.
So we're in Italy, and I'm sitting with two British designers, of one at the start of his career, one having enjoyed a very long and successful career.
Yeah.
Was that good?
Yeah,
I was good. Do you see that, are you excited by what you see in Milan, I guess is a good way of putting it? Is British design exciting at the moment, or is international design from, say, Italy at the moment, or have you seen other exhibitors here from other countries that have particularly grabbed you?
Well, I'd have to judge from last year, because I only got here this morning an hour ago, and I've been here since I arrived. It's always interesting. It's different nationalities, different backgrounds. They always bring something else to the table. I do sometimes feel it can be a little overcrowded. Lots of stuff to see. It's a little daunting sometimes how much really goes on. Once you've been to the Salone and you've seen the thousands of people, it feels like a football ground. And then inside each building, there's new stuff, new lights, new. It's quite impressive. Is sort of a happy word to use, but it's the nationalities which is really interesting. Everyone comes at it with different backgrounds, different walks of life, in ways that, you know, some people are born into money and they come out with something completely different compared to someone that's sort of had to put things together.
I think the sheer volume of what's on offer is daunting and admirable and scary, but it's probably in the same proportion as a similar show almost in any other city, where there's some brilliant pieces and there's miles of crap, because that's the nature of the design trade. You know, I mean, it's become such a commercial handmade design that if you make a buck out of sticking design on whatever it is, you're going to do it. And we come from a society which is so violently commercial, so smartly commercial, so villainously commercial, that we're never surprised by the tricks they buggers get up to. But the same would apply in London. I think will apply when we see the London show in a couple of weeks' time. You know, there'll be a few exciting pieces and so on, and the great lot of stuff that's there because it's a commercial trade. And I don't mind that at all. You know, I don't think it's a holier than thou. I don't want a holier than thou attitude. There was a time when the design trade sort of rather embraced the idea that it was rather a superior job we did. I don't think that's any good at all. I mean, I think what I would like is things to be better rather than worse. And when you come across something that is specifically worse than it was last year, you won't see them here, but you look in the bloody motor cars, all the sodding motor cars are 100 millimetres lower than they were last year, so you can't get into the bastard things. That's not better, is it, by any terms? So I think to the extent that if that's an indicator of the way our trade's going to more and more go, that's not a good sign.
Is that idea of wanting to improve things the driving force of the designer then, or is it to create something which you like to look at?
I mean, I think it should be the driving force, and I don't think there's any downside to it at all. By that I mean that of itself it's not enough. You can't just make it better. What you've got to do is make it better and more desirable. There's the two components that make a successful design. So one without the other's no good at all. And I think you know, we grow up in a society where there's still enough in the ether of the sort of morality of the trade that we'll still be chuddering a long time to come.
Sir Kenneth Grange and Jack Smith in conversation with Alad John there. We'll be back after this short break to hear from the team behind Bassam Fellows.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
While Italian design brands are still the main attraction at Salone, plenty of foreign companies manage to make their voices heard during the week-long event. Some even opt to put down roots in Milan by opening a store. One of the newest entries to the city's design retail landscape is US-based Bassam Fellows. Started in 2003 by Australian architect Craig Bassam and American creative director Scott Fellows, they decided on Milan's Brera neighbourhood to inaugurate early this year their first ever showroom to exhibit their collection of furnishings that looks to combine traditional craftsmanship with a clean, modernist aesthetic. The pair sat down on their newly designed sofa with Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Cavallo to talk retail and manufacturing in the good old US of A.
So Craig, I was curious, now you guys are based in Connecticut, but for your first retail space, you were opening up in Milan.
This is true, it's our first retail space, or our first physical space that represents our brand. And we're here because Milan is still the center of design internationally. And even though we're a US-based company, we see ourselves as an international company. And even when we launched back in 2003, we launched at the Salone di Mobile for that very reason, because it was an international stage. And we've always had somehow an international presence.
So you see Milan, even today with a design calendar, which is packed with events, not just in Europe, but in Asia and elsewhere, that's still Milan, you have to be here.
I think you have to be here. I think it's still the number one place for design, where everybody really does come to Milan. We've all got choices to make, and there's so many shows throughout the world that you can't go to everywhere. And I think Milan is the one place where you basically catch or see and have a chance to meet pretty much everybody that in all of your markets.
Now, all your furniture is made in the U.S., so I'm just wondering, what's the reaction been from shoppers here and people coming to the shop here in Milan to a brand that's got American roots?
I think it's a really nice contrast. People, I think, have really appreciated that contrast of our take of crafts and modern furniture in this very particular Milanese setting. Like, this could only be Milan where we are, but with our brand in here, I think it's really interesting contrast. Yeah, it's really interesting to see who's coming in here, because it's pretty much locals obviously walking by thinking, what this is sort of interesting, what's that, to international design people who, this is the beauty of actually being in Milan, is that even throughout the year you get international design people coming here and finding you somehow as well. And we've had people like fashion executives out of the blue walking into the store here and shopping. It's actually really interesting who actually steps in the door. Even from the first moment we opened, we were surprised at the kind of person who would come in here, be some top-level fashion executive who we thought, well, how would they know we even had a store here at this stage? So it's been really amazing.
So Scott, just tell me a bit about the space, because you've found a very unique place to be here in Milan to show your collection.
Well, the space was created by Michele De Lucchi, the architect and designer, and it was really a very serendipitous meeting in a way, because our agent that we're working with here in Milan is also works with Michele on his Produzione Privata line. And so that's how we sort of met each other. And the space itself is very raw, with the exposed concrete and the roughness of the floor that shows sort of the old tile. And then, even aspects of the walls with the old frescoes. And so we're contrasting that with these very sort of finished architectural insertions into the space. So for this year's Salone, we have these brass floating panels that float just off the wall, and that does two things. It gives sort of a finished aspect to the space amongst this sort of this very rawness of the space itself, and it also adds sort of warmth to the environment. Or in this room where we're sitting right now, we've done the same things with rosewood paneled walls that sort of, again, float from the rough concrete and provide sort of a nice sort of warmth and intimacy to the space.
So just tell me a bit about what you've introduced this year at Salone.
For this year's Salone, we're introducing a new sofa series that we're calling the Salon series. And the inspiration behind these pieces are, it's really a study in scale and proportion. We really wanted a group of lounge seating that was sort of more intimately scaled and would be appropriate for smaller spaces. But in addition to that, we also wanted pieces that would be great for more intimate conversation. So we often find that a lot of lounge seating is so overscaled and actually not very comfortable when you're sitting and having a conversation. It's great for lounging around, but if you wanted to sit and have a conversation like we're doing now, it's not actually not that comfortable. So this piece really achieves that. It has this system of layered cushions, and the layered cushions really give it a sense of sort of softness and delicacy, but at the same time really gives you comfort. The leather itself is actually a Scandinavian leather, but the manufacturing is all made in the United States. We really believe a lot in the resurgence of American craft, because a lot of U.S. manufacturing is really on an industrial scale, and much less of it recently has been on a sort of a more smaller scale or a more craft scale. And but we're really starting to see that come back in a big way in all different kinds of industries, and especially in the design industry or furniture making, or there's really, you see more and more of it.
So in some ways, it's kind of like what you see in Italy in terms of some of the companies that are working with, you know, local suppliers, small craftsmen workshops.
So we work in very much the same way of many of the Italian companies, in that there are a number of different sub-suppliers, and each of those sub-suppliers is very specialized with a very specialized skill set. So, for example, our brass work comes from a blacksmith shop that does all of the brass work by hand. We have another shop that does all the upholstery detailing. We have another shop that does all of the carving of the walnut. So all of those, it's sort of like a conductor of an orchestra with all of those specialists to get to the piece.
Craig Bassam and Scott Fellows of Bassam Fellows talking to our Milan correspondent, Ivan Cavallo. This is Section D and our episode on Salone del Mobile. Back at the main Fiera trade show, reissues of old classics remained a popular theme. One of our favourites was presented at the stand of Kettle, the Spanish outdoor furniture company. In 1950, Danish husband and wife team Jorgen and Nana Ditzel designed the round basket chair, a wonder in wicker. Kettle are now reissuing two versions of it, one in the original material and one in polyrattan for outside use. At the show, I met their daughters Denny and Vita to discuss the heritage of their parents. Nana was known as the queen of Danish design, and what it's like to see an old classic get updated for the modern day.
It was designed in 1950 by our parents. And their idea at that time was to make a piece of furniture, a chair, which sort of wasn't as heavy, floated a bit, so the bowl of the chair, the seating of the chair, is not directly so heavily attached to the bottom of the chair. And they experimented with it, and they wanted to make to sustain the body of the chair around a frame, so it wasn't directly attached underneath.
Yeah.
And it was a thing that other designers experimented with at the time, amongst others Finu. And our parents, to begin with, were trying to do it in leather, but decided not to and do it in rattan instead.
And how do you think, I mean, it's always sort of a slight question with reissues, just what makes a kind of piece of timeless design that 50 years after it was designed or 60 years after it was designed, that it can still appear quite contemporary? Would you say this about this chair, or is it a sort of a piece of timeless classic design?
Well, many of the furniture designed at that time are now coming back into fashion. And I think it's because of their simplicity and their the quality of the furniture too. And also the material, wood, has come back in as well. And it is classical, so it's more or less timeless. And I think the younger generation today like that kind of furniture. It was an obvious idea maybe for Kettle to do, because they can make it as an indoor chair and an outdoor chair. And they're launching it as an outdoor chair, but also as an indoor chair. And in the outdoor version, they're going to make it in polyrattan and with teak legs and frames, so it can be about, stand the climate outside.
And for our listeners who probably don't know what your parents did, could you sort of give us a little history of kind of your parents' history of design, involvement with design?
No. 1946, they started there. It was quite after their education. They started their own design studio. They both did furniture, textiles, jewelry, and other things, for daily use. And all what they did it together. But in 1961, our father died quite young. He was nearly 40. And our mother, she continued by her own. They were very experimental, both in shapes and materials and new techniques. And
they liked to work together also with, there was another Danish artist at the time called Gunnar Aagaard Andersen, who was a sculptor and an artist painting pictures. And they were very inspired by each other, so sometimes they did kind of environments for exhibitions together. So they didn't only go the traditional way of just making one piece of furniture, they made kind of whole rooms. And at a time, I think it was in the 50s sometime, they once stood up on the dining table at home and they counted all the legs in the room and got to some more than 40. And they thought there must be another way of designing furniture than with all those legs. So they actually decided to use the room in a more three-dimensional way. And they, at a very early stage, already in 52, designed a living room sort of with cushions and lying on the floor and so on. And it was a bit early at the time, but my mum, after our father's death, she did it again later on.
That was Denny and Vita Ditzel talking to me there, a kettle stand in the Fiera Trade Fair. Coming up next, Nike's chief footwear designer, Nathan Van Hook, takes Aled on a tour of their installation in central Milan. And our Josh Fennett sits down with Yves Bahar and the design team at Herman Miller. But first, the Be Open Foundation is a relatively new organisation, a self-titled creative think tank founded and funded by Russian entrepreneur and construction billionaire Yelena Batyrina. Its mandate is to invest in design through education, events and awards. One of these is the Young Talent Award. Design duo Mishla Traxler was shortlisted for this award and won. They told Aled about their work and what they're going to do with the winning prize of €24,000.
The quadrant of the University of Milan has taken on the festival atmosphere of Salone del Mobile. Its large grassy square traps the midday sun, while an installation of solid trapezoidal geometry hosts a plasma screen display, showing moving images that transform its angular shape to an almost amorphous mass. I'm here to meet the recent winners of the newest design award in town, the Be Open Foundation's Young Talent Award. Katerina Mischa and Thomas Traxler of Austrian design studio Mischa Traxler tell me how they came to win and talk me through some examples of their winning work, almost sidelined here amidst the noise of the students and visitors in the university's cloisters.
It was very surprising for us and we are super happy, of course. It gives a lot of freedom, especially like this kind of award, so to develop a new project without kind of constraints of economical reason and so on. So it's really, I think it's a award to make research and
experimentation.
And I think that's very kind of interesting.
So great. Before we look at the new projects that it might help you with, let's look at some of the work which is being displayed in bird cages right next to us right now. Talk me through what we can see on the screen in this birdcage.
Well, I think for the screens, they really made a collage of previous work we did. For example, you can see Collective Works, which is a production process that incorporates the audience, like a machine that just produces if there's somebody interested in it. So the more people come, the more the machine does. And if nobody watches the machine, nothing is happening. So it questions somehow labor and as well where production could go and where do we want production to lead to. And another project is, for example, we just saw the moth lamp. It's a lamp out of water jet cutted moth, and they represent the exact number of still alive moth species from an endangered species in Austria. So the number represents always one piece that is alive.
Yeah, another project is called Relumine, and it all started with a gallery in Vienna, and they asked us to do a project on light, and so we combined actually two old lights we found at the flea market, and they are adapted with new technology and like new painted, and they are combined with a fluorescent tube so that always two lamps are in dialogue in a way and they are kind of working together.
So they're connected through the middle with a fluorescent tube.
Yes.
What technology did you use to affect that?
A fluorescent tube, because we wanted that it saves energy. Because the galleries, it was very interesting because of the ban of old light bulbs. He, for a moment, had problems finding the right sources for old lamps in his collection, like from the 60s and 70s. So he said the designers, they actually had in mind which light bulb goes in, and that actually changed their appearance. And we actually took that statement and made a whole project out of it. So they are now connected with a fluorescent tube in order to save electricity, but at the same time, it really makes the project a whole new typology.
And probably the last project which is on the slide, it's called The Idea of a Tree, and it's a solar-powered autonomous production process which is always producing one object per day. Like the machine starts producing in sunrise and stops at the sunset, And in between, the machine is reacting to the different sun intensities and incorporates that in the design. So each object represents in an abstract way the day and place of production. So if there's like less sun, or if it's cloudy or rainy, you see a kind of dark and thin layer of the object, and if it's really sunny, it becomes thicker and paler. So you can read from the object how the weather conditions were at the day and place of production. So it's a lot about the kind of locality and as well about production processes and how we can combine again or bring back into production natural rhythms and go partly away from 24/7 production, but cherish as well kind of the different conditions of the surrounding.
The prize of 24,000 euros is money much needed for any new design studio. Across town, I meet with Gennady Terebkov, director of the Be Open Foundation, and I asked him why the design community was the lucky recipient of the Be Open's patronage.
The main idea of Be Open is just to give, it is to create a communicational platform, to give an opportunity to young designers easily to communicate with experts and professionals, to fill in the gap between their theoretical knowledge and practical life. That's the idea, that's communication platform. So all our educational activities, all our practical activities, they're based on this idea. And really, when someone is asking me what are the practical outcome of the foundation, the main outcome, of course, is that young people see that their ideas are not going under the table in some cabinets, but they can be really realized. Nevertheless, we're not forcing them to be absolutely practical. We're giving them an opportunity to find their own way that could be both practical, but this practice will not kill their creativity.
It's that creativity Be Open's judges found in Misha Traxler's work, described as matching experimental research and vanguard attitudes with industrial production, posing important questions about manufacturing and consumption. Katerina Misha again.
I think the key thing is that we really want to make projects that communicate, that somehow we always see design as an element of communication between different professions in a way, like be it the factory producing something and want to talk to the client, like to the consumer, in order to have a product. So you need somebody in between to mediate. And the same if we work with a museum in order to explain a certain direction of design, somehow you're somewhere in between in order to tell the story. So for us, the context and the storyline in each project is very important.
Is it an easy process coming up with the ideas that you have together, or do you clash a lot of the time?
We do fight.
But
I think it's in a good way.
Yeah. No, it's a constructive fight. But I think we both need it in a way. It's to develop further and to always make the next step. Otherwise, probably if you're working alone, it's partly that you kind of get this kind of tunnel sight, so that you're very focused on something. But if the two, they kind of widen up again the view on it. So for us, it is really important to discuss. And it takes a long time to develop a project.
That was Thomas Traxler of the Mischler Traxler Design Studio, who won the Be Open Young Talent Award this year in Milan, ending that report there by Alad. Up after the break, Alad takes a tour of Nike's installation at Palazzo Clerici.
At Grundig, we carefully craft equipment to help you make the most out of your kitchen, which is why we named our new oven and hob appliance collection We Care. Our multi-taste oven uses three currents of hot air to cook different dishes simultaneously, with 13 cooking functions to choose from and an LCD display. It's one example of how we strive to perfect our technological innovation so that you can enjoy your home, meal after meal. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to part two of our Salone del Mobile edition of Section D. I'm Tom Morris. Now, should you have passed by Via Clerici in central Milan, you may have wandered past the startling structure in the courtyard of its palazzo, complete with a floating balloon-like dome high above. Were it not for the columns beneath, housing some rather colourful Nike trainers, the brand's association to the installation wouldn't be very clear. But help was on hand, and Alla took a tour of the installation to find out more.
Energy becomes increasingly expensive, and also the building.
In the Palazzo Clerici, you happen upon talks like these, where the issues of the day are fleshed out to a rather small crowd of design devotees, or perhaps just people who fancy a free beer. It's all taking place beneath a piece of flying or floating architecture, the so-called aerostatic dome, the product of a collaboration between Nike and sustainable energy developers MiniWiz. MiniWiz's partner, Johan Bodecker, explains what it is we're standing beneath.
On the top, you have the helium-filled canopy, right? That creates an uplift of 200-some kg, depending on the weather conditions, right? Then underneath, you have a recycled PET-based weaving that links to carbon fiber as a structural element, which you also find in the Kobe shoe. So you're really, really using the least material to create that tension. That is an easy enough concept to understand, but the complexities, just like in the shoe, that hide behind it are really what's fascinating to us, you know, slightly more nerdy people. So for example, in order for the threads to light up at night, for the ropes of the weaving, you need to extrude them in a triangular cross section. It's a quite complicated process that makes sure you reflect more light, right? So it gets to a certain look. In order to get to a certain strength of the material of the balloon, you need to infuse it with silicon in the extrusion process, the sheets that the balloon is made of. In order to uphold these columns, you're actually using recycled glass fiber rods. So all these little details may not spring to mind or may not be apparent to the visitor, but they're really what's hiding behind that, you know, experience. And I'm sure that this is similar to the shoes, where, you know, a lot of the innovation is just so inherent.
Okay, a celebration of innovation and sustainability. But its functionality leaves me a little nonplussed. It's certainly an impressive structure, held together by tiny, colourful fly net fibres that stretch from the helium dome to the columns that in turn house new Nike trainers made with the same Flyknit material. Nathan Van Hook, footwear design director for Nike, describes the material makeup of some of the footwear on display.
It's a Flyknit system, thousands and thousands of cables intertwining and being knitted together. But what's great about it is there's literally zero waste from it. And the other great thing is too that with Nike's Flyknit is being able to weave in the support structures for meteorolateral lockdown. And then the amazing thing about, I think, the Magista is that the cuff went up higher for this proprioception, where the player almost doesn't even feel it on their foot anymore. So it's almost like you just got the plate for traction that you need on the bottom of the foot. And they also put a skin on top of the Flyknit for traction control. I personally love this example because it has so much loft in it, but for football you need that kind of touch.
Yeah, and also the top is quite an unconventional design at the top with the ankle stretching high. Yeah.
But it's something that you've seen forever in socks. So it's kind of it's unconventional, but it's very comprehensible.
Complex stuff, and a reminder of the work that lies behind commercial products when companies have a buck or two to invest in innovation. Flyknit and helium domes put to one side, Nathan and I move on to his career to date and why Nike is a good fit for him.
I like the idea of functional product and also the idea of teaming up with advanced materials. I think that's why I personally love working at Nike, seeing all this amazing work that is done in the kitchen and with other categories, and then how in Nike Sportswear, where I've worked for the last 4.5 years, bringing those innovations for our day-to-day use. Salvatore's wearing Flyknit HDM Lunars, but that same technology is used for the running marathon shoes in the Olympics in London. So it's just if it's going to work for this utmost pinnacle athlete, it's going to be great for our day-to-day use. So I personally, that's why I love working there.
In your role, how do you go about creating a new product? Is it function first? Was it design? What comes to you in your head?
Yeah, I think everything starts with having a problem and then solving for that problem. And then kind of everything else is kind of directly reflects that of how those solutions come together, the form and the aesthetic come together. But, we have an innovation kitchen where people are working on product 5 years out and doing amazing stuff.
Kitchen?
Yeah, kitchens, advanced.
So cooking up creations.
Yeah, they're cooking up the next creations, but we literally get all this amazing innovation that we get to use and trying to bring that product in to make our product lighter, more durable, and more breathable than ever before.
Innovation kitchens, helium domes, and thousands of light reflecting fibers. When you get behind the buzzwords that weigh heavily on this and many other installations in Milan, there is function to be found here in innovation and technology. And thankfully, you don't have to understand it all. For Monocle in Palazzo Clerici, I'm Aled John.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. And finally,
While most focus at Salone del Mobile is placed on the way our homes will look like over the next 12 months, there's plenty to see for our office spaces too. American manufacturer Herman Miller caught our attention with its living office project. Its idea is simple, that furniture and the way an office is designed can determine productivity as well as management techniques and company strategy. Our very own Josh Fennett caught up with Herman Miller's editorial director, Sam Graw, and designer Yves Bahar to talk through what the pair think the offices of the future might look like.
Let's start with the things that you don't think are important to an office. There are things like, in the Google offices, they have slides and beanbags and scooters. I mean, where do you draw the line and what are the things that aren't helpful to the to the idea of an office?
I think our take on that is that each living office is necessarily unique. So beanbags and scooters and slides is Google's culture and works for Google. But it's not about putting that in a magazine and looking at it and saying, oh, we want this for our office. It's about discovering what your unique goals are. What are your drivers? What do you people do? What is the culture that you're trying to instigate? And then how can you create a place that brings that to life? We think that we could have a greater variety of spaces with a variety of kind of character that suit a variety of activities, and that will in effect enable us to do different kinds of work in different kinds of places based on what that work is. And then each organization can kind of have a unique mix of what those places are to suit the work that those people do within that organization.
So Yves, how do you go about addressing the problems of the modern workplace through design? I mean, what was your kind of starting point?
Well, for me, it started 15 years ago when I started Fuse Project. It never felt right to me at the time and throughout to have the kind of formality, the kind of hierarchical environment that was typical at the time, and in many ways is still typical today. So we've always had an office where horizontality is very important, where collaboration is key to our work, it's key to the success of the multiple types of projects we do, but also the multiple types of disciplines that are mixed in every project. It's always been really important to us to see all the work, to have it in front of us. And it's always been really important to us to sort of be able to meet in an ongoing matter. So to meet anytime, any place, throughout the office, and in all kinds of different size groups. So 3.5 years ago, when I started working with Herman Miller, this notion of collaboration, which was really central to this to the public office landscape, is something that we had internalized for a very long time. It was quite a natural for us to start designing under this criteria of collaboration. It was also quite natural for us to see that notion of collaboration as something that needs to happen everywhere in the office, from the desk to group areas to meeting areas, in a way that is fluid and continuous rather than something that is pre-planned.
So you set yourself quite a big challenge there. I mean, how do you go about unpicking our kind of received view of what an office should be like, and what are the kind of tangibles that you end up coming out with?
Well, it wasn't hard for us. I mean, we were kind of waiting for this kind of system, and we've had many discussions over the years about office systems, and if I look back at what was kind of the standard format, the cubicle or the closed office, this was never something that I could relate to. And I could never relate to the notion of hierarchy either. I've always sat in the same desk and in the same chair as the rest of my team. So it wasn't hard for me to challenge that. And I think Herman Miller was ready to look at something from a completely different angle and point of view as well. So it was actually a very natural progression for us, because we needed to move to a bigger space, and we need to kind of think beyond just custom desks, which is what we had lived in. And for Herman Miller, it was a natural as well, because they essentially invented the way people work today. And Herman Miller is very good at reinventing things that are taken for granted.
That was Herman Miller's editorial director, Sam Graw, and designer Yves Bahar talking to our very own Josh Fennett there. And that, I'm afraid, brings us to the end of the second and final part of our Salone del Mobile special. If you can't wait until next year, there's further coverage of this spring's event in the June issue of Monocle, which hits newsstands 15th of May. Thanks to our producer Ale John and Holly Fisher for her editing. I'm Tom Morris. And playing you out, some more Mina. Here she is with Ep Poi. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.